When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 5 of Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Section 5. Moll Flanders. I loved the company, indeed, of men of mirth and wit, men of gallantry and figure, and was often entertained with such, as I was also with others. But I found by just observation that the brightest men came upon the dullest errand, that is to say, the dullest as to what I aimed at. On the other hand, those who came with the best proposals were the dullest and most disagreeable part of the world. I was not averse to a tradesman, but then I would have a tradesman, forsooth, that was something of a gentleman, too, that when my husband had a mind to carry me to the court or to the play, he might become a sword and look as like a gentleman as another man, and not be one that had the mark of his apron strings upon his coat or the mark of his hat on his periwig, that he should look as if he was set on to his sword when his sword was put on to him, and that carried his trade in his countenance. Well, at last I found this amphibious creature, this land-water thing called a gentleman tradesman, and as a just plague upon my folly, I was catched in the very snare which, as I might say, I laid for myself. I said for myself, for I was not trepanned, I confess, but I betrayed myself. This was a draper, too, for though my comrade would have brought me to a bargain with her brother, yet when it came to the point, it was, it seems, for a mistress, not a wife. And I kept true to this notion, that a woman should never be kept for a mistress that had money to keep herself. Thus my pride, not my principle, my money, not my virtue, kept me honest. Though, as it proved, I found I had much better have been sold by my she-comrade to her brother than have sold myself as I did to a tradesman that was rake, gentleman, shopkeeper, and beggar altogether. But I was hurried on, by my fancy to a gentleman, to ruin myself in the grossest manner that every woman did, for my new husband, coming to a lump of money at once, fell into such a profusion of expense that all I had, and all he had before, if he had anything worth mentioning, would not have held it out above 1 year. He was very fond of me for about a quarter of a year, and what I got by that was that I had the pleasure of seeing a great deal of my money spent upon myself, and, as I may say, had some of the spending of it too. "Come, my dear," says he to me one day, "shall we go and take a turn into the country for about a week?" "Ay, my dear," says I, "whither would you go?" "I care not whither," says he, "but I have a mind to look like quality for a week. We'll go to Oxford," says he. "How," says I, "shall we go? I am no horsewoman, and 'tis too far for a coach." "Too far," says he, "no place is too far for a coach and six. If I carry you out, you shall travel like a duchess." Says I, "my dear, 'tis a frolic, but if you have a mind to it, I don't care." Well, the time was appointed. We had a rich coach, very good horses, a coachman, postillion, and two footmen in very good liveries, a gentleman on horseback, and a page with a feather in his hat upon another horse. The servants all called him my lord, and the innkeepers, you may be sure, did the like. And I was Her Honour the Countess, and thus we travelled to Oxford, and a very pleasant journey we had. For, give him his due, not a beggar alive knew better how to be a lord than my husband. We saw all the rarities at Oxford, talked with two or three fellows of colleges about putting out a young nephew that was left to his lordship's care to the university, and of their being his tutors. We diverted ourselves with bantering several other poor scholars, with hopes of being at least his lordship's chaplains, and putting on a scarf. And thus, having lived like quality indeed as to expense, we went away for Northampton, and in a word, in about 12 days' ramble, came home again to the tune of about £93 expense. Vanity is the perfection of a fop. My husband had this excellence, that he valued nothing of expense, and as his history, you may be sure, has very little weight in it, 'tis enough to tell you that in about 2 years and a quarter he broke, and was not so happy to get over into the mint, but got into a sponging-house, being arrested in an action too heavy from him to give bail to, so he sent for me to come to him. It was no surprise to me, for I had foreseen some time that all was going to wreck, and had been taking care to reserve something if I could, though it was not much, for myself. But when he sent for me, he behaved much better than I expected, and told me plainly he had played the fool, and suffered himself to be surprised, which he might have prevented. That now he foresaw he could not stand it, and therefore he would have got me home, and in the night take away everything I had in the house of any value, and secure it. And after that he told me that if I could get away £100 or £200 in goods out of the shop, I should do it. Only, says he, let me know nothing of it, neither what you take nor whither you carry it. For as for me, says he, I am resolved to get out of this house and be gone, and if you never hear of me more, my dear, says he, I wish you well. I am only sorry for the injury I have done you. He said some very handsome things to me indeed at parting, for I told you he was a gentleman, and that was all the benefit I had of his being so, that he used me very handsomely and with good manners upon all occasions, even to the last, only spent all I had, and left me to rob the creditors for something to subsist on. However, I did as he bade me, that you may be sure, and having thus taken my leave of him, I never saw him more, for he found means to break out of the bailiff's house that night or the next, and go over into France, and for the rest of the creditors scrambled for it as well as they could. How I knew not, for I could come at no knowledge of anything more than this, that he came home about 3 o'clock in the morning, caused the rest of his goods to be removed into the mint, and the shop to be shut up. And having raised what money he could get together, he got over, as I said, to France, from whence I had one or two letters from him, and no more. I did not see him when he came home, for he having given me such instructions as above, and I having made the best of my time, I had no more business back again at the house, not knowing but I might have been stopped there by the creditors, for a commission of bankrupt being soon after issued, they might have stopped me by orders from the commissioners. But my husband, having so dexterously got out of the bailiff's house by letting himself down in a most desperate manner from almost the top of the house to the top of another building, and leaping from thence, which was almost 2 stories, and which was enough indeed to have broken his neck, he came home and got away his goods before the creditors could come to seize, that is to say, before they could get out the commission and be ready to send their officers to take possession. My husband was so civil to me, for still I say he was much of a gentleman, that in the first letter he wrote me from France, he let me know where he had pawned 20 pieces of fine Holland for £30, which were really worth £90, and enclosed me the token and an order for the taking them up, paying the money, which I did, and made in time above £100 of them, having leisure to cut them and sell them, some and some to private families as opportunity offered. However, with all of this, and all that I had secured before, I found, upon casting things up, my case was very much altered, and my fortune much lessened. For including the Hollands and a parcel of fine muslins which I carried off before, and some plate and other things, I found I could hardly muster up £500, and my condition was very odd, for though I had no child, I had had one by my gentleman draper, but it was buried, yet I was a widow bewitched. I had a husband and no husband, and I could not pretend to marry again, though I knew well enough my husband would never see England any more if he lived 50 years. Thus, I say, I was limited from marriage, what offer might soever be made me, and I had not one friend to advise with in the condition I was in, at least not one I durst trust the secret of my circumstances to, for if the commissioners were to have been informed where I was, I should have been fetched up and examined upon oath, and all I have saved be taken away from me. Upon these apprehensions, the first thing I did was to go quite out of my knowledge and go by another name. This I did effectually, for I went into the Mint too, took lodgings in a very private place, dressed up in the habit of a widow, and called myself Mrs. Flanders. Here, however, I concealed myself, and though my new acquaintances knew nothing of me, yet I soon got a great deal of company about me. And whether it be that women are scarce among the sorts of people that generally are to be found there, or that some consolations in the miseries of the place are more requisite than on other occasions, I soon found an agreeable woman was exceedingly valuable among the sons of affliction there, and that those that wanted money to pay half a crown on the pound to their creditors, and that run in debt at the sign of the bull for their dinners, would yet find money for a supper if they liked the woman. However, I kept myself safe yet, though I began, like my Lord Rochester's mistress, that loved his company, but would not admit him farther, to have the scandal of a whore without the joy, and upon this score, tired with the place, and indeed with the company too, I began to think of removing. It was indeed a subject of strange reflection to me, to see men who were overwhelmed in perplexed circumstances, who were reduced some degree below being ruined, whose families were objects of their own terror and other people's charity, yet, while a penny lasted, nay, even beyond it, endeavouring to drown themselves, labouring to forget former things, which now it was the proper time to remember, making more work for repentance, and sinning on as a remedy for sin past. But it is none of my talent to preach. These men were too wicked even for me. There was something horrid and absurd in their way of sinning, for it was all a force even upon themselves. They did not only act against conscience, but against nature. They put a rape upon their temper to drown the reflections which their circumstances continually gave them, and nothing was more easy than to see how sighs would interrupt their songs, and paleness and anguish sit upon their brows, in spite of the forced smiles they put on. Nay, sometimes it would break out at their very mouths when they had parted with their money for a lewd treat or a wicked embrace. I have heard them, turning about, fetch a deep sigh, and cry, "What a dog am I! Well, Betty, my dear, I'll drink thy health, though." Meeting the honest wife, that perhaps had not half a crown for herself and three or four children. The next morning they are at their penitentials again, and perhaps the poor weeping wife comes over to him, either brings him some account of what his creditors are doing, and how she and the children are turned out of doors, or some other dreadful news. And this adds to his self-reproaches. But when he has thought and pored on it till he is almost mad, having no principles to support him, nothing within him or above him to comfort him, but finding it all darkness on every side, he flies to the same relief again, viz., to drink it away, debauch it away, and falling into company of men in just the same condition with himself, he repeats the crime. And thus he goes every day one step onward of his way to destruction. I was not wicked enough for such fellows as these yet. On the contrary, I began to consider here very seriously what I had to do, how things stood with me, and what course I ought to take. I knew I had no friends, no, not one friend or relation in the world, and that little I had left apparently wasted, which, when it was gone, I saw nothing but misery and starving was before me. Upon these considerations, I say, and filled with horror at the place I was in, and the dreadful object which I had always before me, I resolved to be gone. I had made an acquaintance with a very sober, good sort of a woman, who was a widow too, like me, but in better circumstances. Her husband had been a captain of a merchant ship, and having had the misfortune to be cast away coming home on a voyage from the West Indies, which would have been very profitable if he had come safe, was so reduced by the loss that though he had saved his life then, it broke his heart and killed him afterwards, and his widow, being pursued by the creditors, was forced to take shelter in the Mint. She soon made things up with the help of friends and was at liberty again, and finding that I rather was there to be concealed than by any particular prosecutions, and finding also that I agreed with her, or rather she with me, in a just abhorrence of the place and of the company, She invited to go home with her till I could put myself in some posture of settling in the world to my mind, with all telling me that it was 10 to 1 but some good captain of a ship might take a fancy to me and court me in that part of the town where she lived. I accepted her offer and was with her 1/2 a year, and should have been longer, but in that interval what she proposed to me happened to herself, and she married very much to her advantage. But whose fortune soever was upon the increase, mine seemed to be upon the wane, and I found nothing present except 2 or 3 boatswains or such fellows, but as for the commanders, they were generally of 2 sorts. One, such as, having a good business, that is to say, a good ship, resolved not to marry but with advantage, that is, with a good fortune. 2, such as, being out of employ, wanted a wife to help them to a ship, I mean, 1, a wife who, having some money, could enable them to hold, as they call it, a good part of the ship themselves, so to encourage owners to come in, or 2, a wife who, if she had not money, had friends who were concerned in shipping, and so could help to put the young man into a good ship, which to them is as good as a portion. And neither of these was my case. So I looked like one that was to lie on hand. This knowledge I soon learned by experience, viz., that the state of things was altered as to matrimony, and that I was not to expect at London what I had found in the country, that marriages were here the consequences of politic schemes for forming interests and carrying on business, and that love had no share, or but very little, in the matter. That, as my sister-in-law at Colchester had said, beauty, wit, manners, sense, good humour, good behaviour, education, virtue, piety, or any other qualifications, whether of body or mind, had no power to recommend, that money only made a woman agreeable, that men chose mistresses indeed by the gust of their affection, and it was requisite to a whore to be handsome, well-shaped, have a good mien and a graceful behaviour, but that for a wife no deformity would shock the fancy, no ill qualities the judgment. The money was the thing. The portion was neither crooked nor monstrous, but the money was always agreeable, whatever the wife was. On the other hand, as the market ran very unhappily on the men's side, I found the women had lost the privilege of saying no, that it was a favour now for a woman to have the question asked, and if any young lady had so much arrogance as to counterfeit a negative, she never had the opportunity given her of denying twice, much less of recovering that false step and accepting what she had but seemed to decline. The men had such choice everywhere that the case of the women was very unhappy, for they seemed to ply at every door, and if the man was by great chance refused at one house, he was sure to be received at the next. Besides this, I observed that the men made no scruple to set themselves out, or to go a fortune hunting, as they call it, when they had really no fortune themselves to demand it, or merit to deserve it, and that they carried it so high that a woman was scarce allowed to inquire after the character or estate of the person that pretended to her. This I had an example of in a young lady in the next house to me, and with whom I had contracted an intimacy. She was courted by a young captain, and though she had nearly 2,000 pounds to her fortune, she did but inquire of some of his neighbours about his character, his morals, or substance, and he took occasion at the next visit to let her know, truly, that he took it very ill, and that he should not give her the trouble of his visits any more. I heard of it, and had begun my acquaintance with her. I went to see her upon it. She entered into a close conversation with me about it, and unbosomed herself very freely. I perceived presently that though she thought herself very ill-used, yet she had no power to resent it, and was exceedingly piqued that she had lost him, and particularly that another of less fortune had gained him. I fortified her mind against such a meanness, as I called it. I told her that as low as I was in the world, I would have despised a man that should think I ought to take him upon his own recommendation only, without having the liberty to inform myself of his fortune and of his character. Also, I told her that as she had a good fortune, she had no need to stoop to the disaster of the time, that it was enough that men could insult us that had but little money to recommend us, but if she suffered such an affront to pass upon her without resenting it, she would be rendered low-prized upon all occasions, and would be the contempt of all the women in that part of the town. That a woman can never want an opportunity to be revenged of a man that has used her ill, and that there were ways enough to humble such a fellow as that, or else certainly women were the most unhappy creatures in the world. I found she was very well pleased with the discourse, and she told me seriously that she would be very glad to make him sensible of her just resentment, and either to bring him on again, or have the satisfaction of her revenge being as public as possible. I told her that if she would take my advice, I would tell her how she should obtain her wishes in both these things, and that I would engage to bring the man to her door again and make him beg to be let in. She smiled at that and plainly let me see that if he came to her door, her resentment was not so great as to give her leave to let him stand long there. However, she listened very willingly to my offer of advice. So I told her that the first thing she ought to do was a piece of justice to herself, namely, that whereas she had been told by several people that he had reported among the ladies that he had left her and pretended to give the advantage of the negative to himself, she should take care to have it well spread among the women, which he could not fail of an opportunity to do in a neighbourhood so addicted to family news as that she lived was. That she had inquired into his circumstances and found he was not the man as to estate he pretended to be. "Let them be told, madam," said I, "that you had been well informed that he was not the man you had expected, and that you thought it was not safe to meddle with him. That you heard he was of an ill temper, and that he boasted how he had used the women ill upon many occasions, and that particularly he was debauched in his morals, etc." The last of which, indeed, had some truth in it, but at the same time I did not find that she seemed to like him much the worse for that part. As I had put this into her head, she came most readily into it. Immediately she went to work to find instruments, and she had very little difficulty in the search, for telling her story in general to a couple of gossips in the neighbourhood, it was the chat of the tea-table all over that part of the town, and I met with it wherever I visited. Also, as it was known that I was acquainted with the young lady herself, my opinion was asked very often, and I confirmed it with all the necessary aggravations, and set out his character in the blackest colours. But then, as a piece of secret intelligence, I added, as what the other gossips knew nothing of, viz., that I had heard he was in very bad circumstances, that he was under the necessity of a fortune to support his interest with the owners of a ship he commanded, that his own part was not paid for, and if it was not paid quickly, his owners would put him out of the ship, and his chief mate was likely to command it, who offered to buy that part which the captain had promised to take. I added, for I confess I was heartily piqued at the rogue, as I called him, that I had heard a rumour, too, that he had a wife alive at Plymouth, and another in the West Indies, a thing which they all knew was not very uncommon for such kind of gentlemen. This worked as we both desire it, for presently the young lady next door, who had a father and mother that governed both her and her fortune, was shut up, and her father forbid him the house. Also, in one place more where he went, the woman had the courage, however strange it was, to say no, and he could try nowhere. But he was reproached with his pride, and that he pretended not to give the women leave to inquire into his character and the like. Well, by this time he began to be sensible of his mistake, and having alarmed all the women on that side of the water, he went over to Ratcliffe and got access to some of the ladies there. But though the young women there, too, were, according to the fate of the day, pretty willing to be asked, yet such was his ill luck that his character followed him over the water, and his good name was much the same there as it was on our side. So that though he might have had wives enough, yet it did not happen among the women that had good fortunes, which was what he wanted. But this was not all. She very ingeniously managed another thing herself, for she got a young gentleman, who, as a relation, and was indeed a married man, to come and visit her two or three times a week, in a very fine chariot and good liveries, and her two agents, and I also presently spread a report all over that this gentleman came to court her. that he was a gentleman of 1,000 pounds a year, and that he was fallen in love with her, and that she was going to her aunt's in the city, because it was inconvenient for the gentleman to come to her with his coach in Redriff, the streets being so narrow and difficult. This took immediately. The captain was laughed at in all companies, and was ready to hang himself. He tried all the ways possible to come at her again, and wrote the most passionate letters to her in the world, excusing his former rashness, and in short, by great application, obtained leave to wait on her again, as he said, to clear his reputation. At this meeting she had her full revenge of him, for she told him she wondered what he took her to be, that she should admit any man to a treaty of so much consequence as that to marriage, without inquiring very well into his circumstances, that if he thought she was to be huffed into wedlock, and that she was in the same circumstances which her neighbours might be in, viz., to take up with the first good Christian that came, he was mistaken. That, in a word, his character was really bad, or he was very ill beholden to his neighbours, and that unless he could clear up some points in which she had justly been prejudiced, she had no more to say to him, but to do herself justice and give him the satisfaction of knowing that she was not afraid to say no, either to him or any man else. With that, she told him that she had heard, or rather raised herself by my means, of his character, his not having paid for the part he pretended to own of the ship he commanded, of the resolution of his owners to put him out of the command, and to put his mate in his stead, and of the scandal raised on his morals, his having been reproached with such and such women, and having a wife at Plymouth and in the West Indies and the like, and she asked him whether he could deny that she had good reason, if these things were not cleared up, to refuse him, and in the meantime to insist upon having satisfaction in points so significant as they were. He was so confounded at her discourse that he could not answer a word, and she almost began to believe that all was true by his disorder, though at the same time she knew that she had been the raiser of all those reports herself. After some time he recovered himself a little, and from that time became the most humble, the most modest, and most importunate man alive in his courtship. She carried her jest on a great way. She asked him if he thought she was so at her last shift that she could or ought to bear such treatment, and if he did not see that she did not want those who thought it worth their while to come farther to her than he did, meaning the gentleman whom she had brought to visit her by way of sham. She brought him, by these tricks, to submit to all possible measures to satisfy her, as well of his circumstances as of his behaviour. He brought her undeniable evidence of his having paid for his part of the ship. He brought her certificates from his owners, that the report of their intending to remove him from the command of the ship and put his chief mate in was false and groundless. In short, he was quite the reverse of what he was before. Thus I convinced her that if the men made their advantage of our sex in the affair of marriage, upon the supposition of there being such choice to be had, and of the women being so easy, it was only owing to this, that the women wanted courage to maintain their ground and to play their part, and that, according to my Lord Rochester, a woman's ne'er so ruined but she can revenge herself on her undoer, man. After these things, this young lady played her part so well that though she resolved to have him, and that indeed having him was the main bent of her design, yet she made his obtaining her to be the most difficult thing in the world, and this she did not by haughty reserved carriage, but by a just policy, turning the tables upon him, and playing back upon him his own game. For as he pretended by a kind of lofty carriage to place himself above the occasion of a character, and to make inquiring into his character a kind of an affront to him, she broke with him upon that subject, and at the same time that she make him submit to all possible inquiry after his affairs, she apparently shut the door against his looking into her own. It was enough to him to obtain her for a wife. As to what she had, she told him plainly that as he knew her circumstances, it was but just she should know his. And though at the same time he had only known her circumstances by common fame, yet he had made so many protestations of his passion for her that he could ask no more but her hand to his grand request, and the like ramble according to the custom of lovers. In short, he left himself no room to ask any more questions about her estate, and she took the advantage of it like a prudent woman, for she placed part of her fortune so in trustees, without letting him know anything of it, that it was quite out of his reach, and made him be very well content with the rest. It is true she was pretty well besides, that is to say, she had about £1,400 in money, which she gave him, and the other, after some time, she brought to light as a perquisite to herself, which he was to accept as a mighty favour, seeing, though it was not to be his, it might ease him in the article of her particular expenses. And I must add that, by this conduct, the gentleman himself became not only the more humble in his applications to her to obtain her, but also was much more the more an obliging husband to her when he had her. I cannot but remind the ladies here how much they place themselves below the common station of a wife, which, if I may be allowed not to be partial, is low enough already. I say they place themselves below their common station, and prepare their own mortifications by their submitting so to be insulted by the men beforehand, which I confess I see no necessity of. This relation may serve, therefore, to let the ladies see that the advantage is not so much on the other side as the men think it is. And though it may be true that the men have but too much choice among us, and that some women may be found who will dishonour themselves, be cheap and easy to come at, and will scarce wait to be asked, yet if they will have women, as I may say, worth having, they may find them as uncommatable as ever, and that those that are otherwise are a sort of people that have such deficiencies, when had, as rather recommend the ladies that are difficult than encourage the men to go on with their easy courtship and expect wives equally valuable that will come at first call. Nothing is more certain than that the ladies always gain of the men by keeping their ground and letting their pretended lovers see they can resent being slighted and that they are not afraid of saying no. They, I observe, insult us mightily with telling us of the number of women, that the wars and the sea and trade and other incidents have carried the men so much away, that there is no proportion between the numbers of the sexes, and therefore the women have the disadvantage. But I am far from granting that the numbers of women is so great, or the number of men so small. But if they will have me tell the truth, the disadvantage of the women is a terrible scandal upon the men, and it lies here and here only, namely, that the age is so wicked and the sex so debauched that, in short, the number of such men as an honest woman ought to meddle with is small indeed, and it is but here and there that a man is to be found who is fit for a woman to venture upon. But the consequence even of that, too, amounts to no more than this, that women ought to be the more nice. For how do we know the just character of the man that makes the offer? To say that the woman should be the more easy on this occasion is to say we should be the forwarder to venture because of the greatness of the danger, which in my way of reasoning is very absurd. On the contrary, the women have 10,000 times the more reason to be wary and backward by how much the hazard of being betrayed is the greater. And would the ladies consider this and act the wary part, they would discover every cheat that offered. For in short, the lives of very few men nowadays will bear a character. And if the ladies do but make a little inquiry, they will soon be able to distinguish the men and deliver themselves. As for women that do not think their own safety worth their thought, that, impatient of their perfect state, resolve, as they call it, to take the first good Christian that comes, that run into matrimony as a horse rushes into the battle, I can say nothing to them but this, that they are a sort of ladies that are to be prayed for amongst the rest of distempered people, and to me they look like people that venture their whole estate in a lottery, where there is 100,000 blanks to one prize. No man of common sense will value a woman the less for not giving up herself at the first attack, or for accepting his proposal without inquiring into his personal character. On the contrary, he must think her the weakest of all creatures in the world, as the rate of men now goes. In short, he must have a very contemptible opinion of her capacities, nay, even of her understanding, that having but one case of her life, shall call that life away at once, and make matrimony, like death, be a leap in the dark. I would fain have the conduct of my sex a little regulated in this particular, which is the thing in which, of all the parts of life, I think at this time we suffer most in. 'Tis nothing but lack of courage, the fear of not being married at all, and of that frightful state of life called an old maid, of which I have a story to tell by itself. This, I say, is the woman's snare. But would the ladies once but get above that fear and manage rightly, they would more certainly avoid it by standing their ground in a case so absolutely necessary to their felicity than by exposing themselves as they do. And if they did not marry so soon as they may do otherwise, they would make themselves amends by marrying safer. She is always married too soon who gets a bad husband, and she is never married too late who gets a good one. In a word, there is no woman, deformity, or lost reputation excepted, but if she manages well, may be married safely one time or other, but if she precipitates herself, it is 10,000 to 1, but she is undone. End of section 5. Section 6 of Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Section 6. Moll Flanders. But I come now to my own case, in which there was at this time no little nicety. The circumstances I was in made the offer of a good husband the most necessary thing in the world to me, but I found soon that to be made cheap and easy was not the way. It soon began to be found that the widow had no fortune, and to say this was to say all that was ill of me, for I began to be dropped in all the discourses of matrimony. Being well bred, handsome, witty, modest, and agreeable, all which I had allowed to my character, whether justly or no, is not the purpose. I say, all these would not do without the dross, which way now becomes more valuable than virtue itself. In short, the widow, they said, had no money. I resolved, therefore, as to the state of my present circumstances, that it was absolutely necessary to change my station and make a new appearance in some other place where I was not well known, and even to pass by another name if I found occasion. I communicated my thoughts to my intimate friend, the captain's lady, whom I had so faithfully served in her case with the captain, and who was as ready to serve me in the same kind as I could desire. I made no scruples to lay my circumstances open to her. My stock was but low, for I had made but about £540 at the close of my last affair, and I had wasted some of that. However, I had about £460 left, a great many very rich clothes, a gold watch and some jewels, though of no extraordinary value, and about £30 or £40 left in linen, not disposed of. My dear and faithful friend, the captain's wife, was so sensible of the service I had done her in the affair above, that she was not only a steady friend to me, but, knowing my circumstances, she frequently made me presents as money came into her hands, such as fully amounted to a maintenance, so that I spent none of my own. And at last she made this unhappy proposal to me, viz., that as we had observed, as above, how the men made no scruple to set themselves out as persons meriting a woman of fortune, when they had really no fortune of their own, it was but just to deal with them in their own way, and, if it was possible, to deceive the deceiver. The captain's lady, in short, put this project into my head, and told me, if I would be ruled by her, I should certainly get a husband of fortune, without leaving him any room to reproach me with want of my own. I told her, as I had reason to do that, that I would give up myself wholly to her directions, and that I would have neither tongue to speak nor feet to step in that affair, but as she should direct me, depending that she would extricate me out of every difficulty she brought me into, into which, she said, she would answer for. The first step she put upon me was to call her cousin, and go to a relation's house of hers in the country, where she directed me, and where she brought her husband to visit me. And calling me cousin, she worked matters so about, that her husband and she together invited me most passionately to come to town and be with them, for they now live in a quite different place from where they were before. In the next place, she tells her husband that I had at least £1,500 fortune, and that after some of my relations, I was like to have a great deal more. It was enough to tell her husband this. There needed nothing on my side. I was but to sit still and wait the events, for it presently went all over the neighbourhood that the young widow at Captain Blank's was a fortune, that she had at least £1,500, and perhaps a great deal more, and that the captain said so. And if the captain was asked at any time about me, he made no scruple to affirm it, though he knew not one word of the matter, other than his wife had told him so. And in this he thought no harm, for he really believed it to be so, because he had it from his wife. So slender a foundation will those fellows build upon, if they do but think there is a fortune in the game. With the reputation of this fortune, I presently found myself blessed with admirers enough, and that I had my choice of men, as scarce as they said they were, which, by the way, confirms what I was saying before. This being the case, I, who had a subtle game to play, had nothing now to do but to single out from them all the prosperest men that might be for my purpose. That is to say, the man who was most likely to depend upon the hearsay of a fortune, and not inquire too far into the particulars. And unless I did this, I did nothing, for my case would not bear much inquiry. I picked out my man without much difficulty, by the judgment I made of his way of courting me. I had let him run on with his protestations and oaths that he loved me above all the world, that if I would make him happy, that was enough. All which I knew was upon supposition, nay, it was upon full satisfaction, that I was very rich, though I never told him a word of it myself. This was my man, but I was to try him to the bottom, and indeed in that consisted my safety, for if he balked, I knew I was undone, as surely as he was undone if he took me. And if I did not make some scruple about his fortune, it was the way to lead him to raise some about mine. And first, therefore, I pretended on all occasions to doubt his sincerity, and told him perhaps he only courted me for my fortune. He stopped my mouth in that part with the thunder of his protestations, as above, but still I pretended to doubt. One morning he pulls off his diamond ring, and writes upon the glass of the sash in my chamber this line: "You I love, and you alone." I read it, and asked him to lend me his ring, with which I wrote under it thus: "And so in love says every one." He takes his ring again, and writes another line thus: "Virtue alone is an estate." I borrowed it again, and I wrote under it: "But money's virtue, gold is fate." He coloured as red as fire to see me turn so quick upon him, and in a kind of rage told me he would conquer me, and writes again thus: "I scorn your gold, and yet I love." I ventured all upon the last cast of poetry, as you'll see, for I wrote boldly under his last: "I'm poor, let's see how kind you'll prove." This was a sad truth to me. Whether he believed me or no, I could not tell. I supposed then that he did not. However, he flew to me, took me in his arms, and, kissing me very eagerly and with the greatest passion imaginable, he held me fast till he called for a pen and ink, and then told me he could not wait the tedious writing on the glass, but pulling out a piece of paper, he began and wrote again, "Be mine with all your poverty." I took his pen and followed him immediately thus: "Yet secretly you hope I lie." He told me that was unkind, because it was not just, and that I put him upon contradicting me, which did not consist with good manners, any more than with his affection. And therefore, since I had insensibly drawn him into this poetical scribble, he begged I would not oblige him to break it off. So he writes again, "Let love alone be our debate." I wrote again, "She loves enough that does not hate." This he took for a favour, and so laid down the cudgels, that is to say, the pen. I say he took it for a favour, and a mighty one it was if he had known all. However, he took it as I meant it, that is, to let him think I was inclined to go on with him, as indeed I had all the reason in the world to do, for he was the best-humoured, merry sort of a fellow that I ever met with, and I often reflected on myself how doubly criminal it was to deceive such a man. But that necessity, which pressed me to a settlement suitable to my condition, was my authority for it, and certainly his affection to me, and the goodness of his temper, However they might argue against using him ill, yet they strongly argued to me that he would better take the disappointment than some fiery-tempered wretch who might have nothing to recommend him but those passions which would only serve to make a woman miserable all her days. Besides, though I jested with him, as he supposed it, so often about my poverty, yet when he found it to be true, he had foreclosed all manner of objection, seeing, whether he was in jest or in earnest, he had declared he took me without any regard to my portion, and whether I was in jest or in earnest, I had declared myself to be very poor. So that, in a word, I had him fast both ways, and though he might say afterwards he was cheated, yet he could never say that I had cheated him. He pursued me close after this, and I saw there was no need to fear losing him. I played the indifferent part with him longer than prudence might otherwise have dictated to me. But I considered how much this caution and indifference would give me the advantage over him when I should come to be under the necessity of owning my own circumstances to him. And I managed it the more warily, because I found he inferred from thence, as indeed he ought to do, that I either had the more money or the more judgment, and would not venture at all. I took the freedom one day, after we had talked pretty close to the subject, to tell him that it was true I had received the compliment of a lover from him, namely, that he would take me without inquiring into my fortune, and I would make him a suitable return in this, viz., that I would make as little inquiry into his as consisted with reason, but I hoped he would allow me to ask a few questions, which he would answer or not as he thought fit, and that I would not be offended if he did not answer me at all. One of these questions related to our manner of living, and the place where, because I had heard he had a great plantation in Virginia, and that he had talked of going to live there, and I told him I did not care to be transported. He began from this discourse to let me voluntarily into all his affairs, and to tell me in a frank, open way all his circumstances, by which I found he was very well to pass in the world. But that great part of his estate consisted of 3 plantations which he had in Virginia, which brought him in a very good income, generally speaking, to the tune of £300 a year, but that if he was to live upon them would bring him in 4 times as much. Very well, thought I, you shall carry me thither as soon as you please, though I won't tell you so beforehand. I jested with him extremely about the figure he would make in Virginia, but I found he would do anything I desired, though he did not seem glad to have me undervalue his plantations, so I turned my tail. I told him I had good reason not to go there to live, because if his plantations were worth so much there, I had not a fortune suitable to a gentleman of £1,200 a year, as he said his estate would be. He replied generously he did not ask what my fortune was. He had told me from the beginning he would not, and he would be as good as his word. But whatever it was, he assured me he would never desire me to go to Virginia with him, or go thither himself without me, unless I was perfectly willing, and made it my choice. All this, you may be sure, was as I wished, and indeed nothing could have happened more perfectly agreeable. I carried it on as far as this with a sort of indifferency that he often wondered at, more than at first, but which was the only support of his courtship. And I mention it the rather to intimate again to the ladies that nothing but want of courage for such an indifferency makes our sex so cheap, and prepares them to be ill-used as they are. Would they venture the loss of a pretending fop now and then, who carries it high upon the point of his own merit, they would certainly be less slighted, and courted more. Had I discovered really and truly what my great fortune was, and that in all I had not full £500 when he expected £1,500, yet I had hooked him so fast, and played him so long, that I was satisfied he would have had me in my worst circumstances, and indeed it was less a surprise to him when he learned the truth than it would have been, because having not the least blame to lay on me, who had carried it with an air of indifference to the last, he would not say one word, except that indeed he thought it had been more, but that if it had been less, he did not repent his bargain, only that he should not be able to maintain me so well as he intended. In short, we were married, and very happily married on my side, I assure you, as to the man. For he was the best-humoured man that every woman had, but his circumstances were not as good as I imagined, as, on the other hand, he had not bettered himself by marrying so much as he expected. When we were married, I was shrewdly put to it to bring him that little stock I had, and to let him see it was no more. But there was a necessity for it, so I took my opportunity one day when we were alone to enter into a short dialogue with him about it. "My dear," said I, "we have been married a fortnight. Is it not time to let you know whether you have got a wife with something or with nothing?" "Your own time for that, my dear," says he. "I am satisfied that I have got the wife I love. I have not troubled you much," says he, "with my inquiry after it." "That's true," says I, "but I have a great difficulty upon me about it, which I scarce know how to manage." "What's that, my dear?" says he. "Why," says I, "'tis a little hard upon me, and 'tis harder upon you. I am told that Captain Blank, meaning my friend's husband, has told you I had a great deal more money than I ever pretended to have, and I am sure I never employed him to do so." "Well," says he, "Captain Blank may have told me so, but what then? If you have not so much, that may lie at his door, but you never told me what you had, so I have no reason to blame you if you have nothing at all." "That is so just," said I, "and so generous, that it makes my having but a little a double affliction to me." "The less you have, my dear," says he, "the worse for both of us, but I hope your affliction you speak of is not caused for fear I should be unkind to you for want of a portion." "No, no, if you have nothing, tell me plainly, and at once. I may perhaps tell the captain he has cheated me, but I can never say you have cheated me, for did you not give it under your hand that you were poor? And so I ought to expect you to be." "Well," said I, "my dear, I am glad I have not been concerned in deceiving you before marriage. If I deceive you since, 'tis near the worse. That I am poor is too true, but not so poor as to have nothing neither." So I pulled out some bank bills and gave him about £160. "There's something, my dear," said I, "and not quite all neither." I had brought him so near to expecting nothing by what I had said before, that the money, though the sum was small in itself, was doubly welcome to him. He owned it was more than he looked for, and that he did not question by my discourse to him, but that my fine clothes, gold watch, and a diamond ring or two had been all my fortune. I let him please himself with that £160 two or three days, and then, having been abroad that day, and as if I had been to fetch it, I brought him £100 more home in gold, and told him there was a little more portion for him, and in short, in about a week, I brought him £180 more, and about £60 in linen, which I made him believe I had been obliged to take with £100, which I gave him in gold, as a composition for a debt of £600, being little more than 5 shillings in the pound, and overvalued too. "And now, my dear," says I to him, "I am very sorry to tell you that there is all, and that I have given you my whole fortune." I added that if the person who had my £600 had not abused me, I had been worth £1,000 to him, but that as it was, I had been faithful to him, and reserved nothing to myself, but if it had been more, he should have had it. He was so obliged by the manner, and so pleased with the sum, for he had been in a terrible fright lest it had been nothing at all, that he accepted it very thankfully. And thus I got over the fraud of passing for a fortune without money, and cheating a man into marrying me on pretence of a fortune, which, by the way, I take to be one of the most dangerous steps a woman can take, and in which she runs the most hazard of being ill-used afterwards. My husband, to give him his due, was a man of infinite good nature, but he was no fool, and finding his income not suited to the manner of living which he had intended, if I had brought him what he expected, and being under a disappointment in his return of his plantations in Virginia, he discovered many times his inclination of going over to Virginia to live upon his own, and often would be magnifying the way of living there, how cheap, how plentiful, how pleasant, and the like. I began presently to understand this meaning, and I took him up very plainly one morning, and told him that I did so, that I found his estate turned to no account at this distance compared to what it would do if he lived upon the spot, and that I found he had a mind to go and live there, and I added that I was sensible he had been disappointed in a wife, and that finding his expectations not answered that way, I could do no less to make him amends than to tell him that I was very willing to go over to Virginia with him and live there. He said 1,000 kind things to me upon the subject of my making such a proposal to him. He told me that however he was disappointed in his expectations of a fortune, he was not disappointed in a wife, and that I was all to him that a wife could be, and he was more than satisfied in the whole when the particulars were put together, but that this offer was so kind that it was more than he could express. To bring the story short, we agreed to go. He told me that he had a very good house there, that it was well furnished, that his mother was alive and lived in it, and one sister, which was all the relations he had. That as soon as he came there, his mother would remove to another house, which was her own for life, and his after her decease, so that I should have all the house to myself, and I found all this to be exactly as he had said. To make this part of the story short, we put on board the ship which we went in a large quantity of good furniture for our house, with stores of linen and other necessaries, and a good cargo for sale, and away we went. To give an account of the manner of our voyage, which was long and full of dangers, is out of my way. I kept no journal, neither did my husband. All I can say is that after a terrible passage, freighted twice with dreadful storms, and once with what was still more terrible, I mean a pirate who came on board and took away almost all our provisions, and, which would have been beyond all to me, they had once taken my husband to go along with them, but by entreaties were prevailed with to leave him. I say, after all these terrible things, we arrived in York River, in Virginia, and coming to our plantation, we were received with all the demonstrations of tenderness and affection by my husband's mother that were possible to be expressed. We lived here altogether, my mother-in-law, at my entreaty, continuing in the house, for she was too kind a mother to be parted with. My husband, likewise, continued the same as at first, and I thought myself the happiest creature alive, when an odd and surprising event put an end to all that felicity in a moment, and rendered my condition the most uncomfortable, if not the most miserable, in the world. My mother was a mighty cheerful, good-humoured old woman. I may call her old woman, for her son was above 30. I say she was very pleasant, good company, and used to entertain me, in particular, with abundance of stories to divert me, as well of the country we were in as of the people. Among the rest, she often told me how the greatest part of the inhabitants of the colony came thither in very indifferent circumstances from England, that, generally speaking, they were of two sorts. Either, first, such as were brought over by masters of ships to be sold as servants, such as we call them, my dear, says she, but they are more properly called slaves. Or, secondly, such as are transported from Newgate and other prisons, after having been found guilty of felony and other crimes punishable with death. When they come here, says she, we make no difference. The planters buy them, and they work together in the field till their time is out. When 'tis expired, said she, they have encouragement given them to plant for themselves, for they have a certain number of acres of land allotted them by the country, and they go to work to clear and cure the land, and then to plant it with tobacco and corn for their own use. And as the tradesmen and merchants will trust them with tools and clothes and other necessaries upon the credit of their crop before it is grown, so they again plant every year a little more than the year before, and so buy whatever they want with the crop that is before them. Hence, child, says she, man, a Newgate bird, becomes a great man, and we have, continued she, several justices of the peace, officers of the trained bands, and magistrates of the town they live in, that have been burnt in the hand. She was going on with that part of the story, when her own part in it interrupted her, and with a great deal of good-humoured confidence, she told me she was one of the second sort of inhabitants herself. That she came away openly, having ventured too far in a particular case, so that she was become a criminal. And here's the mark of it, child, says she, and pulling off her glove. Look ye here, says she, turning up the palm of her hand, and showed me a very fine white arm and hand, but branded in the inside of the hand, as in such cases it must be. This story was very moving to me, but my mother, smiling, said, You need not think a thing strange, daughter. For as I told you, some of the best men in this country are burnt in the hand, and they are not ashamed to own it. There's Major Blank, says she. He was an eminent pickpocket. There's Justice Bar Blank, was a shoplifter, and both of them were burnt in the hand, and I could name you several such as they are. We had frequent discourses of this kind, an abundance of instances she gave me of the like. After some time, as she was telling me some stories of one that was transported but a few weeks ago, I began, in an intimate kind of way, to ask her to tell me something of her own story, which she did with the utmost plainness and sincerity. How she had fallen into very ill company in London in her young days, occasioned by her mother sending her frequently to carry victuals and other relief to a kinswoman of hers who was a prisoner in Newgate, and who lay in a miserable starving condition, was afterwards condemned to be hanged, but having got respite by pleading her belly, dies afterwards in the prison. Here my mother-in-law ran out in a long account of the wicked practices in that dreadful place, and how it ruined more young people than all the town besides. "And, child," says my mother, "perhaps you may know little of it, or it may be have heard nothing about it, but depend upon it," says she, "we all know here that there are more thieves and rogues made by that one prison of Newgate than by all the clubs and societies of villains in the nation. 'Tis that accursed place," says my mother, "that half peopled this colony." Here she went on with her own story so long and in so particular a manner that I began to be very uneasy. But coming to one particular that required telling her name, I thought I should have sunk down in the place. She perceived I was out of order, and asked me if I was not well, and what ailed me. I told her I was so affected with the melancholy story she had told, and the terrible things she had gone through, that it had overcome me, and I begged of her to talk no more of it. "Why, my dear," says she very kindly, "what need these things trouble you? These passages were long before your time, and they give me no trouble at all now. Nay, I look back on them with a particular satisfaction, as they have been a means of bringing me to this place." Then she went on to tell me how she very luckily fell into a good family, where, behaving herself well and her mistress dying, her master married her, by whom she had my husband and his sister, and that by her diligence and good management after her husband's death she had improved the plantations to such a degree as they then were, so that most of the estate was of her getting, not her husband's, for she had been a widow upwards of 16 years. I heard this part of the story with very little attention, because I wanted much to retire and give vent to my passions, which I did soon after, and let any one judge what must be the anguish of my mind when I came to reflect that this was certainly no more or less than my own mother, and I had now had 2 children, and was big with another by my own brother, and lay with him still every night. End of section 6. Section 7 of Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Section 7. Moll Flanders. I was now the most unhappy of all women in the world. Oh, had the story never been told me, all had been well. Had it been no crime to have lain with my husband, since as to his being my relation, I had known nothing of it. I had now such a load on my mind that it kept me perpetually waking. To reveal it, which would have been some ease to me, I could not find would be to any purpose, and yet to conceal it would be next to impossible. Nay, I did not doubt but I should talk of it in my sleep, and tell my husband of it whether I would or no. If I discovered it, the least thing I could expect was to lose my husband, for he was too nice and too honest a man to have continued my husband after he had known I had been his sister. So that I was perplexed to the last degree. I leave it to any man to judge what difficulties presented to my view. I was away from my native country, at a distance prodigious, and the return to me unpassable. I lived very well, but in a circumstance insufferable in itself. If I had discovered myself to my mother, it might be difficult to convince her of the particulars, and I had no way to prove them. On the other hand, if she had questioned or doubted me, I had been undone, for the bare suggestion would have immediately separated me from my husband, without gaining my mother or him, who would have been neither a husband nor a brother. So that between the surprise on one hand and the uncertainty on the other, I had been sure to be undone. In the meantime, as I was but too sure of the fact, I lived therefore in open avowed incest and whoredom, and all under the appearance of an honest wife, and though I was not much touched with the crime of it, yet the action had something in it shocking to nature, and made my husband, as he thought himself, even nauseous to me. However, upon the most sedate consideration, I resolved that it was absolutely necessary to conceal it all and not make the least discovery of it, either to mother or husband. And thus I lived with the greatest pressure imaginable for 3 years more, but had no more children. During this time, my mother used to be frequently telling me old stories of her former adventures, which, however, were no ways pleasant for me, for by it, though she did not tell it me in plain terms, yet I could easily understand, joined with what I had heard myself of my first tutors, that in her younger days she had been both whore and thief, but I verily believed she had lived to repent sincerely of both, and that she was then a very pious, sober, and religious woman. Well, let her life have been what it would then, it was certain that my way of life was very uneasy to me, for I lived, as I have said, but in the worst sort of whoredom, and as I could expect no good of it, so really no good issue came of it, and all my seeming prosperity wore off, and ended in misery and destruction. It was some time indeed before it came to this, for I know not by what ill fate guided, everything went wrong with us afterwards, and that which was worse, my husband grew strangely altered, forward, jealous, and unkind, and I was as impatient of bearing his carriage as the carriage was unreasonable and unjust. These things proceeded so far that we came at last to be in such ill terms with one another that I claimed a promise of him, which he entered willingly into with me when I consented to come from England with him, viz. That if I found the country not to agree with me, or that I did not like to live there, I should come away to England again when I pleased, giving him a year's warning to settle his affairs. I say, I now claimed this promise of him, and I must confess I did it not in the most obliging terms that could be in the world neither, but I insisted that he treated me ill, that I was remote from my friends, and could do myself no justice, and that he was jealous without cause, my conversation having been unblameable, and he having no pretence for it, and that to remove to England would take away all occasion from him. I insisted so peremptorily upon it that he could not avoid coming to a point either to keep his word with me or to break it. And this, notwithstanding, he used all the skill he was master of, and employed his mother and other agents to prevail with me to alter my resolutions. Indeed, the bottom of the thing lay at my heart, and that made all his endeavours fruitless, for my heart was alienated from him as a husband. I loathed the thoughts of bedding with him, and used 1,000 pretences of illness and humour to prevent his touching me, fearing nothing more than to be with child by him, which to be sure would have prevented, or at least delayed, my going over to England. However, at last I put him so out of humour that he took up a rash and fatal resolution. In short, I should not go to England, and though he had promised me, yet it was an unreasonable thing for me to desire it, that it would be ruinous to his affairs, would unhinge his whole family, and be next to an undoing him in the world, that therefore I ought not to desire it of him, and that no wife in the world that valued her family and her husband's prosperity would insist upon such a thing. This plunged me again, for when I considered the thing calmly, and took my husband as he really was, a diligent, careful man in the main work of laying up an estate for his children, and that he knew nothing of the dreadful circumstances that he was in, I could not but confess to myself that my proposal was very unreasonable, and what no wife that had the good of her family at heart would have desired. But my discontents were of another nature. I looked upon him no longer as a husband, but as a near relation, the son of my own mother, and I resolved somehow or other to be clear of him, but which way I did not know, nor did it seem possible. It is said by the ill-natured world of our sex that if we are set on a thing, it is impossible to turn us from our resolutions. In short, I never ceased poring upon the means to bring to pass my voyage, and came that length with my husband at last as to propose going without him. This provoked him to the last degree, and he called me not only an unkind wife, but an unnatural mother, and asked me how I could entertain such a thought without horror, as that of leaving my two children, for one was dead, without a mother, or to be brought up by strangers, and never to see them more. It was true, had things been right, I should not have done it, but now it was my real desire never to see them, or him either, any more, and as to the charge of unnatural, I could easily answer it to myself, while I knew that the whole relation was unnatural in the highest degree in the world. However, it was plain that there was no bringing my husband to anything. He would neither go with me nor let me go without him, and it was quite out of my power to stir without his consent, as anyone that knows the constitution of the country I was in knows very well. We had many family quarrels about it, and they began in time to grow up to a dangerous height, for as I was quite estranged from my husband, as he was called, in affection, so I took no heed to my words, but sometimes gave him language that was provoking, and in short strove all that I could to bring him to a parting with me, which was what above all things in the world I desired most. He took my carriage very ill, and indeed he might well do so, for at last I refused to bed with him, and carrying on the breach upon all occasions to extremity, he told me once he thought I was mad, and if I did not alter my conduct he would put me under cure, that is to say, into a madhouse. I told him he should find I was far enough from mad, and that it was not in his power or any other villain's to murder me. I confess at the time I was heartily frightened at his thoughts of putting me into a madhouse, which would at once have destroyed all the possibility of breaking the truth out, whatever the occasion might be, for that then no one would have given credit to a word of it. This, therefore, brought me to a resolution, whatever came of it, to lay open my whole case. But which way to do it, and to whom, was an inextricable difficulty, and took me many months to resolve. In the meantime, another quarrel with my husband happened, which came up in such a mad extreme as almost pushed me on to tell him it all to his face. But though I kept it in so as not to come to the particulars, I spoke so much as put him into the utmost confusion, and in the end brought out the whole story. He began with a calm expostulation upon my being so resolute to go to England. I defended it, and one hard word bringing on another, as is usual in all family strife, he told me I did not treat him as if he was my husband, or talk of my children as if I was a mother, and in short that I did not deserve to be used as a wife, that he had used all the fair means possible with me, that he had argued with all the kindness and calmness that a husband or a Christian ought to do, and that I made him such a vile return that I treated him rather like a dog than a man, and rather like the most contemptible stranger than a husband, that he was very loath to use violence with me, but that, in short, he saw a necessity of it now, and that for the future he should be obliged to take such measures as should reduce me to my duty. My blood was now fired to the utmost, though I knew what he had said was very true, and nothing could appear more provoked. I told him, for his fair means and his foul, they were equally contemned by me, that for my going to England I was resolved on it, come what would, and that as to treating him not like a husband, and not showing myself a mother to my children, there might be something more in it than he understood at present, but for his further consideration I thought fit to tell him thus much, that he neither was my lawful husband, nor they lawful children, and that I had reason to regard neither of them more than I did. I confess I was moved to pity him when I spoke it, for he turned pale as death, and stood mute as one thunderstruck, and once or twice I thought he would have fainted. In short, it put him in a fit something like an apoplex. He trembled, a sweat or dew ran off his face, and yet he was cold as a clod, so that I was forced to run and fetch something for him to keep life in him. When he recovered of that, he grew sick and vomited, and in a little while after was put to bed, and the next morning was, as he had been indeed all night, in a violent fever. However, it went off again, and he recovered, though but slowly, and when he came to be a little better, he told me that I had given him a mortal wound with my tongue, and he had only one thing to ask before he desired an explanation. I interrupted him, and told him I was sorry I had gone so far, since I saw what disorder it put him into, but I desired him not to talk to me of explanations, for that would but make things worse. This heightened his impatience, and indeed perplexed him beyond all bearing, for now he began to suspect that there was some mystery yet unfolded, but could not make the least guess at the real particulars of it. All that ran in his brain was that I had another husband alive, which I could not say in fact might not be true. But I assured him, however, there was not the least of that in it. And indeed, as to my other husband, he was effectually dead in law to me, and had told me I should look on him as such, so I had not the least uneasiness on that score. But now I found the thing too far gone to conceal it much longer, and my husband himself gave me an opportunity to ease myself of the secret, much to my satisfaction. He had laboured with me 3 or 4 weeks, but to no purpose, only to tell him whether I had spoken these words only as the effect of my passion, to put him in a passion, or whether there was anything of truth in the bottom of them. But I continued inflexible, and would explain nothing, unless he would first consent to my going to England, which he would never do, he said, while he lived. On the other hand, I said it was in my power to make him willing when I pleased, nay, to make him entreat me to go. And this increased his curiosity, and made him importunate to the highest degree, but it was all to no purpose. At length he tells all this story to his mother, and sets her upon me to get the main secret out of me, and she used her utmost skill with me indeed. But I put her to a full stop at once by telling her that the reason and mystery of the whole matter lay in herself, and that it was my respect to her that had made me conceal it, and that, in short, I could go no farther, and therefore conjured her not to insist upon it. She was struck dumb at this suggestion, and could not tell what to say or to think, but laying aside the supposition as a policy of mine, continued her importunity on account of her son, and, if possible, to make up the breach between us two. As to that, I told her that it was indeed a good design in her, but that it was impossible to be done, and that if I should reveal to her the truth of what she desired, she would grant it to be impossible, and cease to desire it. At last I seemed to be prevailed on by her importunity, and told her I dared trust her with a secret of the greatest importance, and she would soon see that this was so, and that I would consent to lodge it in her breast if she would engage solemnly not to acquaint her son with it without my consent. She was long in promising this part, but rather than not come at the main secret, she agreed to that too, and after a great many other preliminaries I began, and told her the whole story. First I told her how much she was concerned in all the unhappy breach which had happened between her son and me, by telling me her own story and her London name, and that the surprise she saw I was in upon that occasion. Then I told her my own story, and my name, and assured her, by such other tokens as she could not deny, that I was no other, no more or less, than her own child, her daughter, born of her body in Newgate, the same that had saved her from the gallows by being in her belly, and the same that she had left in such and such hands when she was transported. It is impossible to express the astonishment she was in. She was not inclined to believe the story, or to remember the particulars, for she immediately foresaw the confusion that must follow in the family upon it. But everything concurred so exactly with the story she had told me of herself, and which, if she had not told me, she would perhaps have been content to have denied, that she had stopped her own mouth, and she had nothing to do but to take me about the neck and kiss me, and cry most vehemently over me, without speaking one word for a long time together. At last she broke out, "Unhappy child," says she, "what miserable chance could bring thee hither, and in the arms of my own son, too?" "Dreadful girl," says she, "why, we're all undone, married to thine own brother, 3 children and 2 alive, all of the same flesh and blood. My son and my daughter lying together as husband and wife, all confusion and distraction for ever, miserable family, what will become of us? What is to be said? What is to be done?" And thus she ran on for a great while, nor had I any power to speak, or if I had, did I know what to say, for every word wounded me to the soul. With this kind of amazement on our thoughts, we parted for the first time, though my mother was more surprised than I was, because it was more news to her than to me. However, she promised again to me at parting that she would say nothing of it to her son till we had talked of it again. It was not long, you may be sure, before we had a second conference upon the same subject. When, as if she had been willing to forget the story she had told me of herself, or to suppose that I had forgotten some of the particulars, she began to tell them with alterations and omissions, but I refreshed her memory and set her to rights in many things which I supposed she had forgot, and then came in so opportunely with the whole history that it was impossible for her to go from it, and then she fell into her rhapsodies again and exclamations at the severity of her misfortunes. When these things were a little over with her, we fell into a close debate about what should be first done before we gave an account of the matter to my husband. But to what purpose could be all our consultations? We could neither of us see our way through it, nor see how it could be safe to open such a scene to him. It was impossible to make any judgment or give any guess at what temper he would receive it in, or what measure he would take upon it, and if he should have so little government of himself as to make it public, we easily foresaw that it would be the ruin of the whole family, and expose my mother and me to the last degree. And if at last he should take the advantage the law would give him, he might put me away with disdain, and leave me to sue for the little portion that I had, and perhaps waste it all in the suit, and then be a beggar. The children would be ruined too, having no legal claim to any of his effects, and thus I should see him, perhaps, in the arms of another wife in a few months, and be myself the most miserable creature alive. My mother was as sensible of this as I, and upon the whole we knew not what to do. After some time we came to more sober resolutions, but then it was with this misfortune too, that my mother's opinion and mine were quite different from one another, and indeed inconsistent with one another. For my mother's opinion was that I should bury the whole thing entirely, and continue to live with him as my husband, till some other event should make the discovery of it more convenient, and that in the meantime she would endeavour to reconcile us together, and restore our mutual comfort and family peace, that we might lie as we used to do together, and so let the whole matter remain a secret, as close as death. For child, says she, we are both undone if it comes out. To encourage me to this, she promised to make me easy in my circumstances, as far as she was able, and to leave me what she could at her death, secured for me separately from my husband, so that if it should come out afterwards, I should not be left destitute, but be able to stand on my own feet and procure justice from him. This proposal did not agree at all with my judgment of the thing, though it was very fair and kind in my mother, but my thoughts ran quite another way. As to keeping the thing in our own breasts and letting it all remain as it was, I told her it was impossible, and I asked her how she could think I could bear the thoughts of lying with my own brother. In the next place, I told her that her being alive was the only support of the discovery, and that while she owned me for her child and saw reason to be satisfied that I was so, nobody else would doubt it, but that if she should die before the discovery, I should be taken for an impudent creature that had forged such a thing to go away from my husband, or should be counted crazed and distracted. Then I told her how he had threatened already to put me into a madhouse, and what concern I had been in about it, and how that was the thing that drove me to the necessity of discovering it to her, as I had done. From all which I told her that I had, on the most serious reflections I was able to make in the case, come to this resolution, which I hoped she would like, as a medium between both, viz. That she should use her endeavours with her son to give me leave to go to England, as I had desired, and to furnish me with a sufficient sum of money, either in goods along with me, or in bills for my support there, all along suggesting that he might one time or other think it proper to come over to me. That when I was gone, she should then, in cold blood, and after first obliging him in the solemnest manner possible to secrecy, discover the case to him, doing it gradually, and as her own discretion should guide her, so that he might not be surprised with it, and fly out into any passions and excesses on my account or on hers, and that she should concern herself to prevent his slighting the children, or marrying again, unless he had a certain account of my being dead. This was my scheme, and my reasons were good. I was really alienated from him in the consequences of these things. Indeed, I mortally hated him as a husband, and it was impossible to remove that riveted aversion I had to him. At the same time, it being an unlawful, incestuous living, added to that aversion, and though I had no great concern about it in point of conscience, yet everything added to make cohabiting with him the most nauseous thing to me in the world, and I think verily it was come to such a height that I could almost as willingly have embraced a dog as have let him offer anything of that kind to me, for which reason I could not bear the thought of coming between the sheets with him. I cannot say that I was right, in point of policy, in carrying it such a length, while at the same time I did not resolve to discover the thing to him. But I am giving an account of what was, not of what ought or ought not to be. In their directly opposite opinion to one another, my mother and I continued a long time, and it was impossible to reconcile our judgments. Many disputes we had about it, but we could never either of us yield our own or bring over the other. I insisted on my aversion to lying with my own brother, and she insisted upon its being impossible to bring him to consent to my going from him to England, And in this uncertainty we continued, not differing so as to quarrel or anything like it, but so as not to be able to resolve what we should do to make up that terrible breach that was before us. At last I resolved on a desperate course, and told my mother my resolution, viz., that, in short, I would tell him of it myself. My mother was frightened to the last degree at the very thoughts of it, but I bid her be easy, told her I would do it gradually and softly, and with all the art and good humour I was mistress of, and time it also as well as I could, taking him in good humour too. I told her I did not question, but if I could be hypocrite enough to feign more affection to him than I really had, I should succeed in all my design, and we might part by consent, and with a good agreement, for I might live him well enough for a brother, though I could not for a husband. All this while he lay at my mother to find out, if possible, what was the meaning of that dreadful expression of mine, as he called it, which I mentioned before, namely, that I was not his lawful wife, nor my children his legal children. My mother put him off, and told him she could bring me to no explanations, but found there was something that disturbed me very much, and she hoped she should get it out of me in time, and in the meantime recommended to him earnestly to use me more tenderly, and win me with his usual good carriage. Told him of his terrifying and affrighting me with his threats of sending me to a madhouse and the like, and advised him not to make a woman desperate on any account whatever. He promised her to soften his behaviour, and bid her assure me that he loved me as well as ever, and that he had no such design as that of sending me to a madhouse, whatever he might say in his passion. Also he desired my mother to use the same persuasions to me too, that our affections might be renewed, and we might lie together in a good understanding, as we used to do. I found the effects of this treaty presently. My husband's conduct was immediately altered, and he was quite another man to me. Nothing could be kinder and more obliging than he was to me upon all occasions, and I could do no less than make some return to it, which I did as well as I could. But it was but in an awkward manner at best, for nothing was more frightful to me than his caresses, and the apprehensions of being with child again by him was ready to throw me into fits, and this made me see that there was an absolute necessity of breaking the case to him without any more delay, which, however, I did with all the caution and reserve imaginable. He had continued his altered carriage to me near a month, and we began to live a new kind of life with one another. And could I have satisfied myself to have gone on with it, I believe it might have continued as long as we had continued alive together. One evening, as we were sitting and talking very friendly together under a little awning, which served as an arbour at the entrance from our house into the garden, he was in a very pleasant, agreeable humour, and said abundance of kind things to me relating to the pleasure of our present good agreement, and the disorders of our past breach. And what a satisfaction it was to him that we had room to hope we should never have any more of it. I fetched a deep sigh, and told him there was nobody in the world could be more delighted than I was in the good agreement we had always kept up, or more afflicted with the breach of it, and should be so still. But I was sorry to tell him that there was an unhappy circumstance in our case which lay too close to my heart, and which I knew not how to break to him, that rendered my part of it very miserable, and took from me all the comfort of the rest. He importuned me to tell him what it was. I told him I could not tell how to do it, that while it was concealed from him, I alone was unhappy, but if he knew it also, we should both be so, and that therefore to keep him in the dark about it was the kindest thing that I could do, and it was on that account alone that I kept a secret from him, the very keeping of which I thought would first or last be my destruction. It is impossible to express his surprise at this relation, and the double importunity which he used with me to discover it to him. He told me I could not be called kind to him, nay, I could not be faithful to him if I concealed it from him. I told him I thought so too, and yet I could not do it. He went back to what I had said before to him, and told me he hoped it did not relate to what I had said in my passion, and that he had resolved to forget all that as the effect of a rash, provoked spirit. I told him I wished I could forget it all too, but that it was not to be done. The impression was too deep, and I could not do it. It was impossible. He then told me he was resolved not to differ with me in anything, and that therefore he would importune me no more about it, resolving to acquiesce in whatever I did or said, only begged I should then agree that whatever it was, it should no more interrupt our quiet and our mutual kindness. This was the most provoking thing he could have said to me, for I really wanted his further importunities, that I might be prevailed with to bring out that which indeed it was like death to me to conceal. So I answered him plainly that I could not say I was glad not to be importuned, though I could not tell how to comply. "But come, my dear," said I, "what conditions will you make with me upon the opening this affair to you?" "Any condition in the world," said he, "that you can in reason desire of me." "Well," said I, "come, give it me under your hand, that if you do not find I am in any fault, or that I am willingly concerned in the causes of the misfortune that is to follow, you will not blame me, use me the worse, do me any injury, or make me be the sufferer for that which is not my fault." "That," says he, "is the most reasonable demand in the world, not to blame you for that which is not your fault." "Give me a pen and ink," says he. So I ran in and fetched a pen, ink, and paper, and he wrote the condition down in the very words I had proposed it, and signed it with his name. "Well," says he, "what is next, my dear?" "Why," says I, "the next is that you will not blame me for not discovering the secret of it to you before I knew it." "Very just again," says he, "with all my heart." So he wrote down that also, and signed it. "Well, my dear," says I, "then I have but one condition more to make with you, and that is, that as there is nobody concerned in it but you and I, you shall not discover it to any person in the world except your own mother, and that in all the measures you shall take upon the discovery, as I am equally concerned in it with you, though as innocent as yourself, you shall do nothing in a passion, nothing to my prejudice or to your mother's prejudice, without my knowledge and consent." This a little amazed him, and he wrote down the words distinctly, but read them over and over before he signed them, hesitating at them several times and repeating them. "My mother's prejudice and your prejudice? What mysterious thing can this be?" However, at last he signed it. "Well," says I, "my dear, I'll ask you no more under your hand, but as you are to hear the most unexpected and surprising thing that perhaps ever befell any family in the world, I beg you to promise me you will receive it with composure and a presence of mind suitable to a man of sense." "I'll do my utmost," says he, "upon condition you will keep me no longer in suspense, for you terrify me with all these preliminaries." "Well then," says I, "it is this. As I told you before in a heat, that I was not your lawful wife, and that our children were not legal children, so I must let you know now in calmness and in kindness, but with affliction enough, that I am your own sister, and you my own brother, and that we are both the children of our mother now alive, and in the house, who is convinced of the truth of it, in a manner not to be denied or contradicted." I saw him turn pale and look wild, and I said, "Now remember your promise, and receive it with presence of mind, for who could have said more to prepare you for it than I have done?" However, I called a servant, and got him a little glass of rum, which is the usual dram in that country, for he was just fainting away. When he was a little recovered, I said to him, "This story, you may be sure, requires a long explanation, and therefore have patience and compose your mind to hear it out, and I'll make it as short as I can." And with this I told him what I thought was needful of the fact, and particularly how my mother came to discover it to me, as above. "And now, my dear," says I, "you will see reasons for my capitulations, and that I neither have been the cause of this matter, nor could be so, and that I could know nothing of it before now." "I am fully satisfied of that," says he, "but 'tis a dreadful surprise to me. However, I know a remedy for it all, and a remedy that shall put an end to your difficulties without your going to England." "That would be strange," said I, "as all the rest." "No, no," says he, "I'll make it easy. There's nobody in the way of it but myself." He looked a little disordered when he said this, but I did not apprehend anything from it at that time, believing, as it used to be said, that they who do those things never talk of them, or that they who talk of such things never do them. But things were not come to their height with him, and I observed he became pensive and melancholy, and, in a word, as I thought, a little distempered in his head. I endeavoured to talk him into temper, and to reason him into a kind of scheme for our government in the affair, and sometimes he would be well and talk with some courage about it, but the weight of it lay too heavy upon his thoughts, and in short it went so far that he made attempts upon himself, and in one of them had actually strangled himself, and had not his mother come into the room in the very moment he had died, but with the help of a negro servant she cut him down and recovered him. Things were now come to a lamentable height in the family. My pity for him now began to revive that affection which at first I really had for him, and I endeavoured sincerely, by all the kind carriage I could, to make up the breach. But in short, it had gotten too great a head. It preyed upon his spirits, and it threw him into a long, lingering consumption, though it happened not to be mortal. In this distress I did not know what to do, as his life was apparently declining, and I might perhaps have married again there, very much to my advantage. It had been certainly my business to have stayed in the country, but my mind was restless too, and uneasy. I hankered after coming to England, and nothing would satisfy me without it. In short, by an unwearied importunity, my husband, who was apparently decaying, as I observed, was at last prevailed with. And so, my own fate pushing me on, the way was made clear for me, and my mother concurring, I obtained a very good cargo for my coming to England. End of section 7.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.